So what is a beacon? One of the greatest example I think I've seen currently for using beacons is the ability to detect how close you are, to a specific location in a small area. So for example, let's say you're in a museum and there are many different exhibits and you have your phone on you. Your phone can know which exhibit you're looking at just by being how close you are to a specific exhibit, even though exhibits could be very close to each other, and it can tell you contextual information about that exhibit. Another way you can use beacons is you can collect information about your users, where the users are going, just because they can detect a specific beacon, a specific location. You can target marketing, you can target, you can do some kind of analytics about what the users are, just depending on where they are, you can collect this information. There's many ways you can use them. As I said, it's a device to give you application context of its surrounding. It is a very small device. It uses a Bluetooth low energy, and because it uses Bluetooth low energy, it can also last for a very long time. So you can see you can buy these little devices that last for 4 to 6 months at a time. And many developers or many companies buy a bulk of these devices, and once they run out, they just use another ones because they're very cheap and they last for a very long time. They're very easy to set up. You simply set them up and you just leave them there. And all they do is just advertise their location. They come in a variety of shapes and sizes. That's very important for the design-focused people out there that care about colors and sizes. So how does it work? Once you set up a beacon, once you put the battery in there, it will continuously advertise some data over Bluetooth LE. The data is known as a UUID. It's simply an identifier. It's very simple data. It's usually about 2 bytes of data, and you have a major and a minor that you can set yourself. It also contains a proximity information, or called an RSSI, that can approximately tell you how far you're from one beacon compared to another beacon. And you can also set yourself how fast you want this, how powerful you want the advertisement for this to be. If you want to be able to detect the beacon very far away, I'm talking about several meters, or if you just want to make sure you detect the beacon very close to you, you can set this information to your device. One important thing to note at this point, however, is that you do not need to pair with a beacon to actually detect the beacon. You can be just on your way, walking around, and your phone can be just constantly detecting beacons that are around there. You can collect this information. So the way you build your applications around beacons is you set your application to continuously scan for these beacons around it. You can also set your application to scan for beacons in the background. So you can get a trigger for a background task to be woken up every time a beacon is near your application. Once you know there is a beacon near you, you can grab the data that the beacon is advertising, and you can do some kind of lookup. You don't need to pair with the application. So once you get this lookup, you can check your database, you can check whatever you need to know to get contextual information about that specific beacon. The beacon itself is very dumb and does not really contain much data. You can also use the RSSI to filter or to determine the proximity of the device so you can know which one you're close to. So I have a quick demo I want to show you. I call it Brains, but it's actually a zombie game. So there's a game that I know they played in colleges called Human versus Zombie. Has anybody played Human versus Zombie? Oh, one person. Yay. We can play later. Awesome. No, shake your hand now. So the way you play this game is usually you have a set number of most people are humans, and then you introduce a zombie. And the job of the zombie is to infect all the humans. The winner of the game can be many ways. The winner could be the last person standing, or there's a time limit, and if you don't turn everybody into a zombie, then the zombies lose. Very easy. Usually they play with little guns and they shoot at people, and they play on huge campuses. It lasts for days, and it's super fun. If you haven't played it, we can play it later on. Now, I decided to make my own version of the game using beacons. So I'm going to use 2 different devices. I'm going to use my laptop, and I'm going to use this little phone that I have here. I'm going to run this application, and I'll walk you through the code. So here's the application. It says, my name is Human. I haven't been infected yet. And then I have a phone that's running the exact same application. It's also a human. Now, I don't have a zombie outfit. I should have bought a zombie outfit. So I'm going to turn this phone into a zombie. So it's red now. You can, I don't know if you can see it, but you'll see it that turn red. I'm going to walk slowly, pretend to be the zombie.
I am a zombie. Oh. I'm going to eat your brains.
And as soon as I get close to this, this should turn red as well. There it goes.
Awesome.
Yay.
Yay.
Impressive. Very impressive.
So you can imagine playing this with hundreds of people and people running around, I'm going to eat your brains. Now, let's look at how the code is done here in Windows 10. So I have a Windows 10 application, and I have several methods that I've created. So we have two APIs. Now, one of the things that in Windows 10 you can do is you can actually become a beacon. You can have your application advertise location as if it were a beacon. Now, I don't have a beacon. What I did is I turned one device to advertise its location or advertise some data, and the other device to actually look for this data. So to do this, we have two APIs. We have the Bluetooth LE advertisement publisher, which allows you to create a beacon out of your device, and then the advertisement watcher, which allows you to listen or watch for other beacons around the device. Now, to initialize a publisher or to publish your location, you simply create a new advertisement publisher. You set some data. In this case, I've set a very dumb data, just a binary one. And then I've set a company ID. And then I've simply, and that's all I've done, and I've simply just set the data to the publisher. If I want to start and become the beacon, I get infected. I call this method get infected. I simply call publisher.start. And then at that point, my device will start advertising some Bluetooth LE data, and then other devices can pick this up. If I want to start watching these, I have a watcher, very simple. I can just create an advertising watcher and register to receive events every time there's a beacon around me. And the same way with the publisher, I can simply call watcher.start to start watching for other devices. Now, once I detect the beacon, I can read the data that the beacon contains. So I can get things such as RSSI, and I can get the data that the content is, that the beacon contains, and I can do some lookup or whatever. In this case, every time I detect a beacon, I know it's from the same manufacturer, I simply get infected and I become a zombie myself, and I start advertising my location. Very simple. Now, this is just a very stupid example, if I might say. It's not something that beacons are really meant to do. I just wanted to illustrate an easy way to use this. But you can imagine using these in many different scenarios, a way to collect data about where the user are. You can buy these little beacons in very many different locations and just put them anywhere. They're very easy to use. You can use analytics. You can use Azure to analyze where users are moving. You can collect, you can target marketing. You can do many different things. So I have about a minute left, so I think what we're going to do is we're going to get you all phones. I think we're going to go outside now, and we're going to play a little zombie game, and the winner's going to win a prize.
Really? Yeah. Are you sure?
Really, right? Cool.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
And we need to go on number five.
Which one?
Five.
Okay. Look, I got 42 seconds extra. That's pretty cool. No, here we go, 10 minutes. All right, so let's talk about design. So I've got five particular design tips and tricks for you in this little 10-minute segment. So first of all, we've shipped a technical term, a shared load of controls with this SDK. So make sure you make use of these great controls. Like I said before in the keynote this morning, these are intelligent. They know about the where your app is running. They adapt to the whether it's touch or mouse. And they're really great controls that make it even easier to design and build great apps. But it doesn't mean you have to use them all. One thing you'll notice that's different in Visual Studio 2015 and the Windows 10 design tools is that there's only one new project template called blank. So we're not pushing any great hub control templates or pushing you down a particular path. Those tablets are great for learning, but they tended to end up with lots of apps in the store that all kind of look the same. So we're not really pushing that. We're not pushing any particular controls. What we are pushing for is great user experiences. So we give you all these controls, and we want you to use your ingenuity and your design skills to do what is best for your users. So there are a great number of controls available. Just a few selection here. The relative panel for laying things out relative to each other. The split view control, otherwise known sometimes as the hamburger control. So that's a really great one for laying out content as well. Pivot and tabs and command bar, and obviously many, many more. So just pick the right ones for the job. There's a lot of them, and you can build great UI using those controls. Right, number two. You need to understand the concept of effective pixels. So we've got a scaling algorithm to ensure apps look great across all devices. What this is about is we've got different devices, and you want to build one UI that scales across them. That means actually a particular, if something looks right on a phone, it needs to look right on an Xbox. And from a design point of view, you need to work in something called effective pixels, which takes care of the hardware resolution, the actual screen resolution of your screen, and also takes account of the viewing distance. So it makes adjustments. And what you end up with is this effective pixels, which is independent of those things. So if you use 16 pitch font of text on a phone, and you have a 16 pitch font on an Xbox, it will look kind of the same size because of the viewing distance that's taken into account. So you can just design to this logical pixel size. And there's another magic number, which is the 4x4 grid. So when you're creating a grid to design, we'd use 4x4. Four is the new magic number. So everything should be your margins, your spacing should be multiples of four. And all the values in XAML, margins, spacing, sizes, offsets, they're all now in effective pixels. And there's a bunch of design templates you can use on design.windows.com to help you with your design. Right, now, a lot of people say to me, OK, if I'm designing a UI, I want to scale across lots of different devices. What do I do? Should I start with a big one? Should I start with a small one? Well, generally, the advice is to start small, because that tends to be the more constrained one. It's kind of easier to think, what's the good experience on a small layout, and then scale it out to bigger screen sizes. And what are the snap points, if you like? I mean, we've got an infinite variety of different screen sizes. And also remember that a Windows 10 app on a desktop runs in a window, which can be resized by the user to anything. So effectively, you've got a wide variety of window sizes. Well, we think that ones you should pick as your kind of key design targets would be the 5-inch phone, the 8-inch tablet, but don't forget the portrait and landscape for that, and the 13-inch tablet. Those should be the main ones. And then, obviously, if you want to expand out to the TV or the 84-inch Surface Hub, those are kind of edge cases that you need to think of. Right. How about some techniques for layout? So these are standard web-responsive adaptive design techniques. I'm just going to quickly run through each of them. The first technique for scaling and adapting a UI across different screens is just simply to reposition things. So here we've got an example of two blocks of content which are side by side in a landscape view, and then we simply reposition one on top of the other when we get to portrait or a narrow window, like on a phone. Relative panels, really great for doing that sort of thing, and using Visual State Manager just to move that block of two content and reposition it underneath one rather than to the right of it. Now, the second one, resize. Why not just resize things? Well, yeah, that works up to a point. You have to be a bit careful with that one. Because here we've got some different layouts for a wide screen and a portrait, like a phone screen. And we just make the margins a little bit narrower. We make things, the whole screen, a bit narrower. But that's just a resize. Doesn't always give the great results. So you have to use that one carefully. But reflow is often a better one. You can use reflow, the natural ability of kind of controls to flow text, to resize according to the screen. You can just put a content control onto the page. It will automatically fill it. And you can just have the text flow nicely across multiple columns or a single column. And that's a nice way of making your UI scale across different screen things. A fourth technique, reveal. So this one, if you think about a tablet one, you might want to actually reveal extra capabilities that make sense on the bigger screen that don't make sense on the phone. So on the phone one, we're not actually exposing the ability to draw on the screen. The platform can do it, by the way, but maybe it doesn't make sense for that usage scenario. So reveal is a technique where you expand the user experience out to more capabilities when you're on a bigger screen that can take it. With replace, what we're talking about here is actually replacing the whole UI with something quite different. I talked about the calendar example this morning. So replacing one layout that makes sense on a bigger display with a slightly different one for a smaller one. So here we're using, this is an example of a pivot, for example, where on the tablet, on the PC, where we're using tabs across the top, a tab sort of effect. But then it's actually the same information is presented as a target list on the phone, and the user would tap on one of those items and drop down into a more detailed display. So all these techniques are used to make sense of the different screen sizes. The last one is a complete re-architect. So this one is where you really want to kind of have a radical rethink of the UI. Underneath it, it's your same logic. You're working with the same data. You know, you've got the same code underneath, but you're actually putting on top of it a unique user experience that makes sense for the device where it's running. Number four. No, black and white, that's okay, but no, let's go for color. Make things colorful and bright. There's a whole color spectrum to choose from. Use your own colors. So while it's great, that sort of very flat simplicity that we've got used to over the last few years, judicious use of color to make brighten things up can really add a lot to the enjoyment for users for your app. And if you really want your app to stand out from the rest, you do need to brand it. There's many ways you can brand your app. You can use logo, fonts, graphics, sounds, but the easiest and most impactful is color. So if you're not a designer, you can get some good examples of colors that work well together, that are grouped together, by going to color.adobe.com or colorlovers.com. Great color palettes that you could choose to use as your color scheme for your app. And the fifth one is think about design before you start coding, and then keep thinking about design while you're coding, and then think about design when you're revising as well. Just think about it all the way through. It's really a continuous operation of a continuous improvement. And you know, look at this simple example of a couple of news apps there. Which one would you download? There's one that looks serious and looks like it might be a worthwhile app, and one that's, well, yeah, let's not bother with the other one. Because people judge the quality of your app based on the design before they even download it. So they'll see screenshots. They'll see the icon in the store. So you've got to make that good impression even before they download your app and start using it. It's like a simple statement, but people like nice things. And you know, along that thing, modern design is not boxes. So we often see that building apps are just full of kind of tiles and very blocky and square, kind of driven by the phone design language, but often that's taken to two big extremes. So don't be afraid of changing things and lay things out in a way that makes sense. So those are my five design tips. Make the best use of controls. Design in effective pixels, this logical pixel layout thing. Start with a small and build up, and use your own colors, and then think about your design before you start coding, and just keep thinking about it thereafter. That's my lot.
10 seconds left.
That's impressive.
Okay, so you put me some pressure. So I guess it's already gone. Okay, so let's talk about Volon.js in a bit more detail. So web development, we already seen that together. It's cross platforms. It's really cool because it's responsive. We didn't have to wait for XAML to do it when we were web developers, you know. We already had that for a long time ago. It's based on standards, and you can access a huge number of devices. I really think that this is very cool. Debugging is also, you've got F12 in all great browsers, so we've got a great F12 in Microsoft Edge and IE11. Chrome, we've got an awesome F12 tool also. Firefox also have historically a very good F12 tools. So every browser got a cool one. So this is very cool. Let's move to the mobile. If you want to debug,
Chrome and Android, you need to have Chrome on your PC or Mac. If you want to debug a Safari, well, you're forced to have a Mac to do that. So you need to use Safari on a Macintosh to debug a Safari Mobile on an iPad or iPhone. If you want to debug IE Mobile, you need Visual Studio. And there is some other solution available, but the name is too complex for me to pronounce. So I don't know if you managed to pronounce that.
When, is that a word?
Yes. When, yes, it's not possible for me. So I think it's not cool. So you need to find something else. So the idea was to help you solving the mobile debugging, but also going to work on desktop, of course. So Volon.js is really a web remote debugging tool. It's really based on web standards. It's cross-browser platforms. Today, it's based on the plugin mechanism. So when you want to write a new feature, you need to follow our plugin architecture. So we've got some documentation and some article explaining how to do that. So the first plugin we've been writing was the DOM Explorer, the Object Explorer. So DOM is like, you know, having access to the HTML document. Modernizer, if you want to test for a specific feature or to understand why this website is not being displayed correctly on this mobile, you can have access to that. And finally, you can remote execute some code on the device using the immediate window. So let's have a quick demo of that. So currently, I am connected to my Windows phone, and I can have access to the DOM Explorer that way. So it's going to be a bit complex for you to see, but let's see that I'm selecting the paragraph. You can see there is a red rectangle over there, so I can have access to that. I can check using Modernizer what is the level of support of CSS animation, for instance. So CSS animation, so it's going to say that this is supported. And finally, I can, in real time, have access to all JavaScript objects being available, modify them, or execute some code remotely. So this is the aim of that. So now what we're going to do, let's cross fingers, I'm going to connect to all of your devices, if you got a smartphone, having access to the internet. So you're going to connect to these specific URLs. So aka.ms/volon-sample. And you should be able to see the same page I've got here.
Don't do it, it's a virus.
I cannot do some viruses. You are protected by your browser. If you've got a Windows phone, you're perfectly safe. So how many of you have been able to go there? Bunch of you, so let's take some time. Yes, I've got 6 minutes left. So normally, if I'm going back, I can see a lot of phones being connected. So it's cool to be in a Microsoft event because we can see a lot of Windows phones. And I know that in Italy, we've got a great market share of using Windows phones. Thank you for that. So what I'm going to do now is, let's imagine that one of you says that website is not being displayed properly. So I need to know who you are. So first thing I need to press is to identify you. You should have a number. So it's a number on one of the lists. So let's say, for instance, you're not lucky, you've got an Android device, and you've got a problem. So you are number six. Who is number six? Over there. Thanks. Are you ready to play the game with me? So we don't know each other, OK? This is not a trick. This is not a Jedi trick, OK? So I'm going to connect to your Android phone. OK, so we're using Socket.io, so it could take time. So normally, if I'm clicking on the P, it should be highlighted on your phone, Windows phone. Yes, it works. Can you say, yes, it works. Thank you. And what I'm going to do, I'm going to change, for instance, the CSS of that. So let's change that, the background color to red. Red. Did it work? Yes, it worked. And finally, I can have access to the support. So you've got an Android device, so they support a lot of things because you're using Chrome, which is fairly impressive browser. And now I can even say, hello, you. And I'm going to execute that. Can you see that? Yes. So I can have access to this phone because I'm currently hosting Volon.js. Normally, Volon.js is supposed to be hosted on your web machine. And you've got to insert just a line of script code into your website to analyze it on your devices. But if we host that in Azure, because it's based on Node.js and Socket.io and stuff that we're supporting in Asia. So thanks to that, I'm able to connect to your phones. So let's do that on a... So usually, I cannot do more than one phone. I still don't know why. But let's try identify someone else. And let's try, for instance... So there is some iPhone with number 33. 33, just over there. So let's try to connect to your phone. Does it work? Yes, it worked also on iPhone. You see, it's normal because we are based really on classical JavaScript code and nothing linked to a specific platforms. So today you can go on our website and test it on volonjs.com. You will see how to install it, how to fork it, how to go on GitHub and ask for specific requests. You see that we already have some cool number of stars, so you can vote for it. And we are currently working on a network plugin to have access to network and have access to all that. I'm working on a web audio one. The idea is to remote debug what's going on web audio on your phone using the dashboard, same mechanism. And we also have a team contributing, currently writing an AngularJS plugin for us. So it's really open. If you have an idea, you think that's something that's lacking to debug the web experience on devices, you can suggest the idea to us, or even better, you can code it for us and submit it on our GitHub. And I think I'm done. Thank you.
You have like two more minutes.
Yes, it's the power of the web.
You have any jokes?
Any jokes? No.
Let's talk about Cortana, something actually interesting. It's a joke. So we've talked about Cortana before. Cortana has been available on Windows Phone 8.1 for about a year now, actually. We announced it in Build 2014. In Build 2015, we announced that Cortana is coming to all devices. Actually, we announced it even before that. It's coming to Windows Desktop as well. So all the power of Cortana is coming out everywhere. And if you build applications that integrate within Cortana on Windows Phone, you'll be right at home on Windows 10. We're extending the exact same model to support all the Windows 10 applications, so you can write really cool integrations with Cortana. So why are you here? Why are we talking about Cortana? So a couple of things you can do with the speech platform and Cortana right now. Speech recognition has been available on the platform and keeps improving. It's actually very cool to use. I'm going to have to show you a quick demo. It allows you to recognize a user speaking, get the text that the user has said, and you can actually synthesize text to talk to the user, so you can have a conversation with the machine. And then when you actually talk to Cortana, you can integrate deeply with Cortana. You can allow Cortana to call in within your application. So a user can call Cortana to open up your application, go to a specific place within your application. Hey, Cortana, open a specific movie using this application, for example. And this has been available in Windows Phone 8.1. It's available across desktop now. Now, we've also have some cool new functionality built into Windows 10 now that they're extending on top of what's already available. That's the ability to get information directly from Cortana without opening up your application. So you can have deep integration within Cortana. So a user can actually have a conversation with Cortana, and Cortana can call in within your application to get the information to present to the user as if Cortana were talking to the user. So you can ask, how many followers do I have? And Twitter can respond via Cortana. You have two followers in some cases. Your application actually wouldn't even be opened, and it's all handled in a background task. So I have a quick demo that I want to show you. I call it Speak to Me. Now, the story behind this demo is very simple. Now, I'm not a popular person. I don't have many friends. These guys here are just hanging out with me because we have to present together. We're colleagues. We're not really friends. We don't even talk outside of work.
No, never.
No. So I built an application to be my best friend. I call it my best friend. It's actually a very simple application. It uses the same design principles that Andy was talking about. It's very clean, and it's something that I'm very proud of when I built this application. As you can see, it's beautiful. There you go. So copyrighted, of course, as the before. And it's very simple. I can say hi, and it's a very dumb best friend, and it can't really do it much. I was just born and can't speak well yet. I had a very smart bot before, that was really inappropriate, so I couldn't show you that because my boss said I'll get fired. So I'll have to use this Dumbo bot. But let's go ahead and show you how you actually implement some of this functionality. So I have this listen button. So I press this listen button. Hopefully, I'll be able to talk to my best friend. I like you.
That was kind.
And it will speak back to me. I don't know if you guys heard it, but it was talking back to me.
Okay.
And it keeps recognizing me as I keep speaking.
I was just born and can't speak well yet.
Yeah. So you can see, I can actually talk to it and it can respond back to me. It's very easy to implement. So let me show you the code. Here we go. I have three functions. First one is to initialize speech. All I do is I use the speech recognizer API. I compile a compilation result. This is essentially a dictionary that you want to use with the speech recognition. In this case, I'm using the default dictionary that goes out to Bing to recognize the text that has been spoken and return back the text. You can use your own dictionary. You can make it completely offline with your own text that you want it to recognize. Once I've initialized the speech recognition, I can start listening for text. To do that, I specifically call the Recognize Async API. This API is actually pretty fascinating. It will listen for what I say, it will detect when I've stopped talking, and it will package that into a string and just give it to me. And then I can call this again and I can keep talking to it. And it's very easy to use. So here you can see I'm getting the result in form of a string. And then just to speak back to the user, all I do is I use the speech synthesizer API. I can use this API to generate some text. I can pass in a string that I wanted to synthesize. And I'm using a media element to set the source to the stream that is generated by the speech synthesizer. It's very easy to implement. It's only about 20 lines of code just to implement this. So it's very easy to use. Now, that's not the only feature I implemented within my application. You know, I want to be able to activate my best friend wherever I am. So I'm walking down the street. I don't want to go find my application best friend. I want to say, hey, best friend, talk to me kind of thing. So I've implemented integration within Cortana. So what I can do, I can say here, for example, let me show you how this works. Best friend, I want to talk. And let me try that. Best friend, I want to talk. And we can just look at each other.
I think you've lost your friend.
Best friend, I want to talk. There you go, and it's going to start up my application, and it's going to start talking to me. Yes, we got that. God. It's hard working with a baby bot, you know. Anyway, so you can see my application was turned on, and I sent some command to actually start talking to me. Now, the way I did this, I used this voice command definition file. So it's a simple XML file that you specify commands that you want to activate on. So in this case, I want to listen for I want to talk. I've specified that I need to specify the name of the application, which is right here. I've called best friend. And it can be before or after the phrase. So I can say best friend, I want to talk. Or I can say I want to talk best friend. There's also ways to set the name of the app to be said specifically somewhere in the middle of the sentence, for example. I've also created another message that says let's chat or can I ask and sending some message and then when Cortana will actually open my application, pass in this arbitrary message that I've set to Cortana and open up my application. Once I have this XML file, I can simply just initialize the voice command definition with Cortana. And to do that, I simply call this very short API that we've created called install command definition from storage file async. Very easy to remember. And we pass in the storage file, this XML file. One important thing to remember is you can actually generate this in runtime, this file. You don't have to ship this with applications. So you can keep modifying the commands in runtime. You don't have to do this. So if you have parameters or anything you want to add later on, you don't have to reship your application. I've also added one more feature to my application. That's the ability to talk to Cortana, to my application, just through Cortana. My application doesn't have to start up so my best friend can respond. And to do that, I have it done here within my VCD file. I have this command called let me tell you, and then I pass in a message. And you notice here, I have this voice command service. In the previous commands, I simply said navigate, and this opens up my application. But in this case, I'm opening up a voice command service, and this is actually a background service that I've created, and this is using the same app-to-app services that I talked about earlier in my session. So when I call this method, this command, it would actually open up my my app service, and my app service will respond on behalf of my application. So I can say something like, go ahead and run this. Best friend, let me tell you, I love you.
That's a job for best friend. That was kind.
And my best friend responds, that was kind.
So cute.
It's very cute, I know. I'm still trying to teach it some nice things to say to me, but it's, yeah. So this was very easy to implement. You can look at the code for the background service right here. You can see that simply when the application has been instantiated, I get the trigger details for this background service. I can pull out the information that was being sent to me, and I can get the message. In this case, I said, I love you. And I asked my bot to respond to that. And once I got the response, I simply sent the response to Cortana to respond on behalf of this application. I don't have much time. So just to finish up, there's a couple more things. I just did a quick overview. Now, Cortana Extensibility also works in a host of web applications that David was talking about. It actually works really well. You can use Recognize with UI Async if you don't want to create your own UI for the user to see. This will pop up with a pop-up for the user to say something. Continuous Recognition Session allows you to have a session that's for the lifetime of your application, so you can listen for commands, in-app commands, just like similar to the way the Xbox works. In the app service, you can actually prompt. We have Q&A later, so you can ask me questions.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, these guys get all the cool demos. I just doing all these really worthy subjects. But hey, what's the matter? All right, store monetization.
Super fun.
So we brought together these platforms in Windows Desktop, Windows Mobile, Xbox. We've now got this one-stop shop, this store for the end user, where they can get everything they want, games, music, videos, all sorts of apps. And we're constantly optimizing the store experience and investing in this with new features and store APIs for developers and ISVs, which enables them to scale up on reach, provide immersive experience in your app, and give great opportunities for monetization. And we got great support in Windows 10, much better support for business ISVs and for enterprises, and I'll be talking about those in this. So all these great new features, including, you know, campaign attribution and video interstitial ads and ad mediations, a whole suite of services through the store that we are bringing with Windows 10. And coupling with that, of course, we've got one destination for developers supporting all Windows devices. You just need one developer registration now. It's just one app submission up to the store. And all these great features that we've built in, including free rich analytics, customer acquisition, and more customer engagement. And one payout for all of your apps available from this one dev center. The preview's up now. If you've already got apps in the store from Windows 8 days, Windows Phone 8.1, take a look, because we're kind of merging all those experiences together into one converged experience in the new portal, which you can go and have a look at the preview up on dev.windows.com. So let's drill down into three key areas of the new Windows Store experience. First of all, the enhanced analytics. I'm going to look at interstitial ads and how you implement them. It's very easy. And then I'm just going to do a quick run-through of the business store and what that means. So first of all, obviously, when you've built an app and you're planning your campaign to get it out there and get publicity for it, you're going to think of various different channels for publicizing it. You might go on Twitter or Facebook or through social channels or do email campaigns or blog posts. Or there's a whole variety of ways that you can actually get users to know about your app. But up until now, it's been very difficult to test which of those channels has been successful. Well, now the dev portal understands this idea of campaigns. So you can assign a campaign ID and you can embed that campaign ID in links that you embed in any of these like tweets or your blog posts or any way that the user clicks in order to get through to the store to discover your app. And now you can go and look at the output from that and the analytics from that and take a look on the on a web portal to find out information about how users are acquiring your app. And also at runtime, if you want to do special promotions to a user according to how they acquired your app, you can get the information with that little snippet of code there. You can get the campaign ID async. And we've got, with this provided data analytics, you can now assess and engage more thoroughly about how users are using your app. And we've also got automatically translated reviews. So you have review comments from users and you don't understand their language, you can actually now view them in the language of your choice. And we can also engage with reviewers. So you've got public responses, so everybody can see your response to somebody who's reviewed your app, or you can actually engage with reviewers privately as well. So great ways of connecting to the people who care, who have taken the trouble to review your app. We've also, in-app purchase is a really popular way of monetizing your app. But we've really increased the reporting on that, so you can really drill down and find out, identify trends across all your apps, and more effectively gauge the effectiveness of in-app purchase to help you plan your future campaigns and future implementation of this. Now we've got, for Windows 10, we've got a preview SDK, which you can download. You need to go off to the website there to adapts.microsoft.com. So you go off there, you can download the preview SDK, install it into your system, and now you can use the new advertising SDK, which includes a great new number of features, and use it in your apps across phone, tablet, and PC. The store's not open for submissions just yet, but you can get ready and test this out using the SDK. So video interstitials are becoming a very popular way of monetizing your apps. The idea here is that you just show a video ad at some point, and that will unlock something for the user, give them access to something else. You typically see this, you go onto a news website and it's got videos. And before you watch the video you're interested in, you're forced to watch a 20-second video. That's an interstitial video. Of course, the app provider gets paid for that. So let's have a just quick look at how that might work. Okay, so here we go. So we've got this stunning, this is a much better UI than any of you guys are coming up with. I'll just run this on local machine. I will run it on local machine. Oh. Right, just a minute. Oh my gosh. I had my external drive on. This is where we've gone wrong. Let's try this again.
You still have 3 minutes and a half.
It's okay. I'm not feeling under pressure here. thanks, guys. I'm under pressure now. Yeah. On the local machine. Yay. Oh, my goodness. All right.
I know XAML stuff.
Yeah, XAML. Who would use it? If you just had this on a website, it would be easy. Yeah, okay. This is live debugging, folks.
Store monetization and debugging, right?
Huh?
Store monetization and debugging session.
Yeah,
exactly. It was part of your lightning talk, I guess.
Yes, so that's right. This is the
we are learning together.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not really sure what you're currently doing, but it's very interesting.
Yeah, I'm trying to get rid of the binary. This is not going to work. Clean. Try me. Come on, live with me. Come on, live with me.
And you can launch it in...
Just need to go and get my external drive, which is behind the thing.
Use a force.
Yeah.
No.
No, we're failing.
Maybe run it as an administrator? I don't know.
Huh? One last try. And then I'm going to quit. I'll show you the code. So the idea of what this app was.
I've seen it working, so he's not lying.
Oh, succeeded. There we go. We stuck with it. Persistence. All right. And really, it's not worth it once you get into this app. So the idea here simply is you have to, you know, you can select a level, but if you want to watch, if you want to play level 3 in this game, you have to tap the button, and as a result of that, you're forced to watch this stunning Xbox interstitial video. So yeah, I can see this for some Forza kind of a game. So when you watch the video, when you've successfully watched it, then it will go back to your game and the level is unlocked. How do we do that? So the code for that is just in here, really, really simple to do. You'll see in OnNavigated 2, we have we knew up an interstitial advert up here, and then down here we have a number of event handlers. And then when we're ready to play it, you request the ad, you preload it, and then when the button is pressed, you show it. And once that is finished, then we can unlock the extra bit of functionality. So there we go, and I'm going to swiftly go back to the slides. It's just gone to the wrong one. Oh, my goodness. Because I wanted to go to the business store. I'm going to hear the klaxon in just a minute. So what our business? We've got the business store, which is a new kind of store within a store. And the idea here is that businesses can purchase apps from the public store and offer it to their internal users. And it supports bulk licensing and license management. So you can, it's not a demo, it's more of a walkthrough. So the administrator is going to sign up for the store on this portal, and then they can go off, this is the signing up for the portal, and then they can go and select apps that are available to curated list to show through the store. So you pick your app, you put it into your list inventory, and then you select the recipients who are going to be able to use it, and then they can install it from the app store. Thank you.
Almost done.
I was actually one slide down, but I hope you actually understood any of that. Sorry to the translators at the back. That's like terrible.
No, you're not sorry.
Okay, last one before the break. So let's talk about audio.
So I am a composer, so I really love music, and I am a web developer, so it was obvious for me to talk about web audio. So my name is David, you don't care about my name. So let's go on the most advanced audio stack for the web. And maybe some of you, let's do a brief of history again. Remember the background sound tag. Who knows that tag? Please, I'm not alone. Ah, oof. So it was at the beginning of the web, we were building some awful website and we were able to play some sound using that. Then we had Flash. It was a plugin, but it was really great to have some audio and videos and supporting a lot of codecs. It was vector-based. It was quite cool, but it was a plugin. So we need something being as a standard, so to work on the W3C on that. So we've written the audio tag. And the audio tag was less much powerful than Flash, but it was a standard, so it was implemented everywhere on IE, on Chrome, and Firefox. But we need something better than the audio tag to reach at least the Flash level. And the last version was web audio, using the dark side of the force. So it's very, very powerful, but it's still very simple to use. So what is web audio in a nutshell? It gives you access to the complete audio stream. Compared to the audio tag, you can do whatever you want with the audio stream. You're going to decode it in memory, and then you're going to put some specific behavior on that. It's a routing graph, meaning that you're going to create some audio node, and you're going to connect together. And based on the audio node and graph you're going to create, you will have a specific behavior. So you can have a specific node to put some filtering, a low or high filter, to play on the gain, which is a volume. You can play on 3D specialization, and you can put some convolver. Convolver is the idea to make the sound like you're speaking into a cathedral or in a room like that with some echoes. So what we're going to do is to create this specific graph together. It will be the first demonstration. So the idea is to create the master volume. that will be connected, thanks to this little arrow, to the final destination, which could be either the speakers or some headphones you're going to connect that. It could be also the hard drive if you want to. Then we're going to create two sounds. It will be my music. So the first music would be loaded that here, and the second music will be loaded here. And each music will have its own volume. So we will be able to play the volume on each track. And finally, that will be connected to the final master volume. So let's have a look to the source code to build this demo. So the first thing you need to do is to create the context of the audio context. And remember what I was saying in my web session. You should not test for a specific user agent. You should feature detect it. So I'm currently testing if audio context is being supported by the browser. If it's the case, I'm going to create it and just set the boolean to true thing that go ahead, you can use web audio. Currently, Chrome is still using the prefix version of audio of the web audio API, so I need to test it also using that. Once I'm sure that I can use web audio, I can create the first master volume. Remember, on the slide, it was this one. So I'm currently creating this specific node. It's not me. I don't know what's going on, but I'm not playing any sound. So this is the magic of the web. So let's go back to my code. Once I've done that, I need to load the sounds. So for that, I've got some specific code. So I've been building, remember, I've been showing you some TypeScript code, so you can write it by yourself. So I'm creating more layer class. So what I need to do is to load it from the web server, so using an HTTP request. It's going to load the sound as a binary using array buffer. Then I'm going to decode it in an asynchronous way. Once it's being decoded in memory, I can say that go ahead, it's ready to be played, okay? The play method is pretty simple. It's going to use the audio context and create the buffer source, remember, on the left of the diagrams. Then I'm going to connect it to its own volume. And finally, don't forget to start the sound, otherwise nothing will occur. So let's play that together in Microsoft Edge. And you can hear beautiful music I've been composing. So I can lower down the main volume, or I can do some mixing. A little bit of violin, a little bit of cello. Now if I want to go further than that, if I want to analyze in real time the sound, I can create a new kind of audio node, which is the analyzer. The analyzer is going to provide me access in real time to all the frequencies of my sound. And I will be able to do whatever I want with that. For instance, let's draw some 2D graphics with that. So let's review what's going on. You can see, in real time, I can have access to JavaScript and with the web audio APIs to the frequencies. So if I'm shutting down the violins, you can see that the cello is synchronized with the output. But the funny thing is I can lower down the main volume. And you can see that the sounds are still being played because I've shut down the master volume, but I haven't stopped the sound. It could be useful for debugging, for instance, if you want to know what's going on in background in the memory currently. Now, if you want to go a little bit further than that, maybe you want to have 3D sounds. To have 3D sounds, I'm going to open the Babylon.js source code. You can see it's written in TypeScript. And I'm going to go directly on the 3D part. So to create 3Ds, I need to create a special kind of audio node, which this time will be on the audio context. It's a panel node. Panel node is in charge of computing all the 3D stuff for you. So you don't have to compute where the sound are. It's going to do that for you. And for instance, if we go back to Microsoft Edge, what I've been doing, I'm creating a 3D scene with free sound in the 3D scene. And what I've done is put some purple sphere on top of my sound just to show you where the sound are currently being played. When I'm moving the camera, I'm asking to Web Audio to update the position of the listener, and it will do everything for me. So if I'm entering this specific sphere, I can hear the sound. And if I'm getting out of the sphere, stop, entering another one. And when I'm at the center of the sphere, the sound is very loud and it's going to go down. Now, if I want to have some real 3D sound, what I can do is to put a sound on top of a 3D object, and if you have the headphone, you can hear the sound turning around your head. So it's currently on my right, it will be in front of me, on my left, and behind me. So it's being handled by Wave Audio using some powerful APIs. So now you know how to load some sounds, to analyze them in real time, to do some 3D stuff. Let's mix that together to create the ultimate experience. Well, an experience I've been building, so I guess it's the ultimate one, with two friends of mine, with David Catchu again and another French guy. So rather than computing the volume based on the distance from the camera, this time I'm going to compute the volume based on the distance from the center of the white circle. And I've attached every track of my music on every cube. And I don't know if you remember the Surface Table application. There was a mixing application for some of them that have been able to play that, so we were inspired by that. So when I'm going to push the cube inside the white circle, it's going to play the sound, and I'm going to analyze the frequency and to do some kind of particle around that to analyze it. You can see, so I can now mix my music using mouse and using touch, using the pointer events, so you can do that like that. I can even do it with my finger. And finally, I've got a stupid joke. You can stick cube together, so if you want to write the French part of the sounds, taking all of them, it's going to play the music, and if I'm just moving all the blocks outside of the circle, it's going to only play the blue one, because if this is only one touching the right circle, you see? So it's a kind of idea you, in a way, you can write some application using Web Audio and 3Ds. And this one also, you see the debugging, it's useful. This source code is available on GitHub again as an open source. It's been written in TypeScript, but you can read the JavaScript compiled version of it if you want to. If you just need to go on dev.modern.ai, and you will be able to find this demonstration and to load the source code and review how we've been able to do that. And I've finished.